This is exactly right.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Alman Updike, and we're the hosts of This Podcast Will Kill You on Exactly Right.
We're back with our seventh season, which is bigger and better than ever.
Because guess what? We're now a weekly show.
This season, we're tackling everything from long COVID to norovirus, from the supplement industry to IVF, and so, so much more.
New episodes drop every single Tuesday.
Follow This Podcast Will Kill You wherever you get your podcasts.
Mode. Throw up on it.
It's got two settings.
Okay, cool. All right.
Can you see me?
I can. Can you see me?
Right down the galley. Mm-hmm. Right down the gauntlet.
Let's keep eye contact this entire episode.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to My Favorite Murder.
It's a true crime comedy podcast.
That's right.
You've been waiting for since last Wednesday.
That's Karen Kilgariff.
I mean,
Thursday.
That's Georgia Hardstark.
We don't know what day it is.
It doesn't matter what day it is. We told you already. Stop being superficial.
Today. Oh, you love Wednesdays.
Oh, I love calendars. Look at me mark my calendar.
I'm so into calendars. Like, you don't even know.
Those squares contain all my plans.
Multitudes. Today, okay. Which is a Wednesday, mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. Is it Tuesday?
No. It's Wednesday.
Okay. Today is a year since the Golden State Killer was caught.
Do you remember?
Happy birthday, Karen.
Happy Golden State birthday,
Thank
Georgia.
Thank you.
I will tell you this right now. I know exactly where I was driving when I saw it on Twitter. And thank you again to that person on Twitter that alerted me at 11 o'clock at night,
mm-hmm.
driving home from something.
I remember that.
Down Moore Park. I fucking look at Twitter. Someone says, could it be this is really happening? Then the texts begin.
You text me. You're the one who informed me. Thank you very much. That's now.
I live for it.
It's now two that you've told me were caught, cold cases that were solved. So you're on a roll.
Thank you. It's my dream to be that person, to be your personal newscaster.
Look out for the Delphi murders when they catch him, because
that's going to matter so much.
Yeah. So
you.
I need you to tell me. That'll be three.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really exciting. I think I woke up from a nap at 11.
Yep, that's right.
And I think you and I were like not talking right then.
Yes.
I think we were like
we had just come off, was it the European tour?
Yeah.
There was something where it was like book and tour and too much of each other.
Stress. And yep. I was just like, okay, we need to take just a week to ourselves.
Can I please have one day? That's the thing I like to say.
And then the Golden State Killer getting caught brought us back together.
Yep. I was just
called
like,
you immediately.
I know you want to talk to me.
That's right.
I know I'm the only person you want to talk to right now.
That's right. Called you.
And these are the sinews that hold the muscles of the exoskeleton, endoskeleton of our relationship together.
That's right. And this podcast.
It is like the ocean where the tide goes out, but baby, it comes back in.
That's right.
Every time.
Save our waters. I don't know. Clean up your...
Please get the plastic shit out of our ocean.
Cut up your six-pack plastic can.
Yes, a seagull's beak is going to get caught in that.
Is that what you want on your conscience?
It's hilarious. It's going to look like a Victorian or a... would that be?
No.
Like a seagull? I thought that was the point is that we're dressing up birds of the ocean as like, what is it? From the 1500s.
It's like avant-garde garb.
Yes, avant-garde, like Grace Jones, or the Restoration, the 1500s.
That's right.
Why would I even make a statement
like that? Let's say the 1500s. So it is.
The 1500s were either the Restoration, the Renaissance, or those two things are the same. This is my point. You don't need to name the Renaissance two things.
There are many history podcasts that you can immediately hang up on this one and turn that on if you want.
And do it.
And we wish you would.
And we wish you well doing it.
We do. Oh, I have a quick podcast recommendation that I just started listening to when we were on the plane home from St. Louis, and I fucking binge it. There's like only four episodes.
Okay.
It's called The Ballad of Billy Balls.
And yes, you've been talking about this.
Oh, and Crimetown put it out. It's like their new season of their crime. And it's hosted by Io Tillett Wright, and he's just such a badass. It's such a fucking good podcast.
Oh.
It's like CB, they're trying to solve a like CBGB era fucking rock rocker's murder.
Ooh.
With the girlfriend of the murder rocker involved, and Io Tillett is also involved, and you don't know how until the third episode, but it's Ooh. So fucking good. I love it so much.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I actually, I guess if we're going to do it, let's do a podcast corner.
Let's do it.
This is our new thing. because I have been listening to so many more lately than normal. I went back because I'd never listened to Atlanta Monster.
Right.
Which I, oftentimes I just stay silent because I'm like, sometimes I'm like, enough. I can't. But I've always been fascinated with the Wayne Williams and the Atlanta Child Killer case and how they used to, when it was just the American Justice episodes
yeah.
type of treatment, it was this thing of it was an open and shut case.
Right.
They caught him on the bridge, da-da-da.
Wayne Williams, period.
But there was other, then there were a couple other shows that would fold in this thing of, isn't that convenient that
yeah.
on the last night of the stakeout on this bridge, they caught this guy? Isn't that convenient? Isn't it convenient? You know, what were they trying to step around? What race issue were they trying to avoid blowing up?
Yeah.
Whatever.
And it was the 80s, right? So that shit was already blowing up.
It was already
especially in Atlanta.
Roiling, yes, and in the South. Anyway, I blazed through it. Obviously, I'm late to the party, so who cares about this? But I just, Payne Lindsay is a great podcaster uh-huh. and did such a good job with this investigation and opening those doors instead of going conspiracy theory or like putting that tinge on it.
Yeah.
It's pulling in this very now modern look of like,
evidence.
Hey, white people, you never look at anything this way because you are, you know, coming from this bias of
yeah.
you don't know what it's like to feel this like police oppression or this
right.
police abuse, constant neglect.
Or you think that the community, the, you know, black community thinks of their children differently than you would, or
right.
somehow it's not as important because it's a child who doesn't look like your child.
Yes.
So, you know, looking at it in that way of like, it's just as important.
Yes.
And those children deserve justice just as much as any fucking white kid does.
And it's the travesty of when social,
right.
oppression, it then creates these victims who are entirely innocent.
Yeah.
And that is another really lovely theme, is that innocence, these innocent children,
yeah.
just because they're out at 11 o'clock at night or whatever, just because their home lives weren't ideal,
right.
they were innocent children.
Yeah.
So it's so good if you haven't, which everyone already has. This is like me recommending Friends. It's a great sitcom to watch, but I just really, it blazed through it and really liked it.
I love it. And that's Podcast
Corner. Ding, ding, ding,
corner,
ding,
corner,
ding,
corner.
Ding, 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 ding.
To talk more about podcasts real quick, Murder Squad, their new episode this week has them, this fucking Paul Holes and Billy Jensen talking about the Golden State Killer, which is like how they met. It's like their fucking thing, you know.
It's their origin story.
And they have a survivor on that they interview, and
amazing.
She's just an incredible woman,
amazing.
And her amazing son. You got the Purrcast. You have the Fall Line, which has this week is Christmas Doe and Dennis Doe, two children who were murdered in Georgia in their cold cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then this podcast will kill you this week is doing the Zika virus.
Oh, how nice!
I just love it.
I do love how the kind of like the concentric circles of interest around. Like, it's like, I like true crime, but I also like other fucked up things
yeah,
that happen.
I love it.
That don't necessarily belong in that
right.
little circle, but they definitely belong in that outer
it's
circle.
It's like, societal woes is my favorite thing.
Sure. However they come down that
yeah.
pipe.
And pretty soon, Exactly Right Network is going to have yet another podcast. We have like so many coming.
Did you call it a podcast?
Did I? While I was grabbing my boobs. Did you notice that?
She's dirty, dirty.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Another podcast that what?
I don't know. We'll have a lot of podcasts coming up soon, so stay tuned. Make sure you follow. Can you do that? Exactly Right Network. Can you follow a network on iTunes?
I don't. Well, you subscribe
to the network?
No, to every individual show probably.
Soon?
You can't subscribe.
How about Spotify?
But you can subscribe to Exactly Right on Twitter. And
there you go.
Jay's the one posting all those Twitter updates of all the shows
and Instagram. Do it.
Please.
We fight about Twitter and Instagram.
We are opposing teams. One is on jokes only and words only. One is pictures.
That's right. What else? Anything?
Yes.
Yeah?
It was.
Oh, I thought you were like in a very serious moment.
No. It was just something before. It was about that.
It was like going around it. Twitter.
Nah.
Lizzo.
Always.
She retweeted you. That was exciting.
That was crazy. She But her album had come out, so she was kind of retweeting everybody that was talking about
it. Yeah,
but she also retweeted Courtney Barnett, who is one of my favorite singer-songwriters.
So good.
Everybody loves Lizzo right now. She is the it girl of the moment.
That's right. Oh, I was going to say something great. Fan cult. We have a fan cult. We're doing all kinds of exciting things. There's contests coming. There's going to be like we're giving away like a lunchbox. It's really weird, but like a book, like based on our book. So like the fan cult and the book.
It's book swag.
Yeah, book swag. It comes out May 28th. I'm sure we're going to be giving away a lot of signed copies. All this shit.
Yeah, but fan cult only. We have to be exclusive about it.
Yeah, I mean, so we'll give you a few too. We can't afford it.
Exclusive.
Okay, all right. Exclusive.
But basically, it's join the insider circle so you know everything that we're doing.
Yeah, and it's better than it used to be. Should we get started?
Yep.
Who's first?
Ugh, this again.
Me? Based on the weekend, Steven?
No, based on the Power Rangers.
Okay.
Being the first.
Based thing. On reality. We have to do it okay. Based on what the listener's reality, not our reality.
I always forget which one's which.
I know.
What is reality?
I have
truly
knows. I mean, believe me.
Okay.
I'm doing. Okay, bye.
Okay. I do. I'm doing the murder of Hella Crafts, aka the wood chipper murder, aka the first episode of Forensic Files.
No.
Yes.
Amazing.
And I was like up all night. What murder do I do? Because the one I did ended up being too gruesome. And I'm like, you can't fucking do that, Georgia. So I was like looking for a new one. And I was like, well, I wonder what the first episode of Forensic Files is. Found it. I was like, oh my God, how have we not done this?
I love this idea.
Right?
It's so smart.
Thank you. I'm very smart. And this is before Forensic Files had started naming their episodes really weird shit. Like, yeah. You know, pun. Skirting the issues.
Yes, when it's like always a bad pun.
Right. And this was just called The Disappearance of Hella Crafts. Okay. And her name is Hella. H-E-L-L-E is how you spell it. But right. It's Hella.
Okay.
So I got a lot of info from morbidology.com. There's an article by Emily Thompson. And also, of course, our friend Murderpedia.
Yes.
Especially an article by Mark Gatto. Hella Crafts was born Heller Lorch Nielsen on July 4th, 1947. She grew up in a small village in Denmark.
Okay.
And she's vibrant. She's outgoing. She made friends easily. She's super fucking smart. By the time when she was a teenager, she had learned French and English and was able to understand German, Norwegian, and Swedish. So I know only three of those. And I... That's a lie. I'm not even great at English.
Do you remember when we were in Scandinavia trying to pronounce those fucking city names?
Skjorg. Yeah.
And my favorite was, and I know we've told this story, but going up and making people in the front row tell us how to pronounce it. Meanwhile, they were speaking absolutely perfect, like California English, where they're like, don't worry about it. We don't really care. We're like, oh my God.
Or they were all like expats who didn't know how to say it either, or they had just come to... you know, Amsterdam to see us.
Yeah, they were just on vacation. It was hilarious.
Stop asking us shit.
Yeah.
So yeah, she would have been good at that.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time she was 20, Hella is a beautiful young woman. I showed Vince a photo and I was like, who does she look like? Because I need to explain. And he immediately was like, Emily Watson.
Oh, wow.
So the actress Emily Watson wore an East Coast, like, housewife.
Mm.
That's what she looked like.
Awesome.
And it's exactly like her. She became a Dutch stewardess. What do we say now? Not stewardess. Flight attendant.
Flight attendant or air hostess? I'm not sure.
I'm going to go flight attendant.
Okay.
And then she loved discovering new places. It was like a perfect job for her because she was so outgoing and friendly and everyone fucking loved her, of course. Then she found out that Pan American Airlines.
Pan Am
was hiring.
Sure.
She applied along with 200 other people for 8 spaces available and she got one.
Yeah. Which is, sorry to say, but that is kind of like a beauty contest because back then, that's kind of what it was. It was like the Hooters of the air. But not in an objectification way.
You also had to be a good, you know,
hostess. Yes. You had to be good at like up close customer service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't they have like a Pan Am experience here in LA somewhere where you can do like you have dinner as if you were on a Pan Am flight from the 60s?
No.
So I follow this incredible woman. Her name is Allison Martino. She's the daughter of Al Martino, who was this singer in the fucking 50s and 60s, like old Los Angeles crooner type of dude.
Mm-hmm.
And she does these like crazy experiences and tells you all this history of LA. So she went on this Pan Am experience and it's like, they serve you the food they would have served you.
We have to do that.
Steven, you looked it up and what did you find?
Air Hollywood's Pan Am Experience is a weekly retro-themed event for aviation enthusiasts and people looking for a new fine dining experience.
I am.
You always say.
I always, with my long fake nails, point at you and
with your Capri.
Yes. Georgia, hold on. Let me take a sip of this wine spritzer.
Okay. Well, we'll go. It's going to be a My Favorite Murder
event.
Outing.
The field trips are beginning.
That's right.
And then we have to do reports on field trips.
Yeah. Go. Steven's our bus driver.
Great.
Okay. Okay. Where were we? I don't fucking know. She becomes a Pan Am.
That's right. She won out of 200 people. She got top 8.
That's right. So she's sent to Miami for training, and it was there on May 24th, 1969, the height probably of Miami at the time.
Yeah.
That she met 31-year-old Richard Crafts. Crafts, like I'm crafting.
Okay.
He's a pilot for Eastern Airlines. And to me, there's not a lot of photos of him, but I wrote, if Mr. Rogers were a dick and an insurance salesman, that's what he looks like.
So Mr. Rogers, but more tan and more buff.
Yeah. And like not friendly face.
The warmth is gone.
The warmth's gone. And he's trying to sell you shitty stocks or something.
Bummer. You know,
he's trying to get you to get in on this Ponzi scheme.
He's a Ponzi type.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, like, fucking RIP to Mr. Rogers, and I'm sorry to desecrate your beautiful name.
But we need a baseline.
That's right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. When he met Hella in 1969, he was already engaged to someone else, but they hooked up. They maintain an on-again, off-again relationship for the next few years. They fought all the time, her friend said, sometimes in public. Her friends didn't like him. They're like, you can get any fucking dude, and this Mr. Rogers looking motherfucker.
And they're like, you need to join Adult Children of Alcoholics or some shit like that, because clearly you're a chaos addict.
That's right.
Yeah.
Chaos addict. That's good. Oh, you're pointing. Can I say that you're pointing at yourself?
Sure.
You pointed at yourself with gusto.
I love chaos.
Oh, are you?
Yes. Oh, my God.
How are we friends?
I don't know.
Well, you know what? Maybe I love chaos addicts.
Yeah, I don't think you mind chaos yourself.
I know.
Yeah. But it's weird. It's like,
I don't want to.
You don't want to think of yourself that way.
Yeah.
But for me, that's the thing of like being late or not turning things in or whatever. It's like, now what's going to happen?
Oh.
So there's a little bit of, I'm pretending that somehow means I'm in control, which I'm not.
I feel like I'm chaotic and I have anxiety about it and I hate it and I don't want to be.
Right. Same.
Okay. That's what that means.
But there's almost like, if it's what you grew up with, then it feels like mother's milk. So you kind of go like, it's my baseline.
Dude.
And you don't want it to be. So there's shame.
Can I side anecdote?
Please.
And I meant to mention this. My mom got married.
Yes.
Last week, after having been with my now new stepdad, which is the weirdest. I've never had a step parent in my life.
And what's your new line?
What's my new line?
You're not my real dad.
You're not my real dad, John. But we love John. She's been with him for like 15 years. Yeah. He's the best fucking person. I adore him. I get a text message on Tuesday to 14 other people. It was a group text, including phone numbers I didn't have in my phone. So fucking strangers to me. Mm-hmm. And my mom said, surprise, we got married. Who fucking does it? And then when I said to her, you know, I was just like, that's so Janet. It's fine. I'm so happy for you. Wonderful, wonderful. And then later when we talked, I was like, you know, I really would have loved a phone call, like just to tell me that this happened. And she's just like, oh, I'm such a bad mom. Oh, did that.
Well, here's the thing though. She's the kind of person that like it is deadly to be wrong for her. It's deadly to be wrong. And you can't even like just even put in one suggestion in the suggestion box.
All I want is, yeah, I could see why you'd want that. That's
right.
It.
I know.
You My didn't mom, have to do it. Just understand that.
Just hear what I'm saying and see and like readjust your perspective. My mom was the exact same way, where anytime I would just be like, you know what kind of sucks? And she'd be like, oh, I'm sorry you get everything you want, all that. Where it was like, no complaint was valid.
No.
Which is why when then that comes up for me, where I just like, you then just time travel into having these fights because you did that when you were 11 with the person that was in charge of reality.
Jesus Christ.
All right. Go ahead.
How are we successful based on our fucking...
Oh, my life. Seriously.
Lit your bed on fire as a like 4-year-old.
I lit my fucking life on fire, friend. I was just telling somebody this where I was just like, right up till this podcast got popular, I was sliding down the face of the mountain into the fucking death pool. Like, I was done.
And you were like, hands up, excited, like on a roller coaster.
Yeah, I was like here we go. Fuck it all. Yeah.
Whew, and then we both pulled each other up.
Yep, thank
that
you.
Mountain.
Hey. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Georgia.
Thank you, Karen. Mm. Where were we?
Janet. We're calling Janet on
Janet,
the phone.
Janet. God damn it. Damn it, Janet. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. They're together. It's volatile. they probably shouldn't have been. But then in 1975, Hella found out that she was pregnant.
Oh.
And they decided to get married.
Sure.
Okay. They bought a one-level ranch house in the city of Newtown, where Hella had her first child. And then over the next few years, she had two more. So they have three kids together. Richard picks up a second job as an auxiliary police officer.
Is that a security guard?
I think it's like, yeah, it's like a part-time cop, which shouldn't be a thing without all the, like, you don't get all the bells
training.
And whistles.
You don't know how to do anything, right. But you have a gun.
That's right. But like, he also was like kind of a dick about it. Like, he bought the exact same kind of police car that they had and would put like wires and shit on it. Like, he just would come to the station even when he wasn't on shift. Like, he really wanted, and he was like really enforced whatever fucking baby, whatever he had. Enforced the any power, any baby power that he had, he like double time.
Oh, got it. Yeah. So it's like, oh, so you can write up someone a citation.
Right.
But it isn't really a ticket. And they're like, yeah, I'll fucking write citations all day.
All day about every little thing. And it's like, calm down, dude.
Yeah.
So,
therapy.
It's great. He's doing that. She's continuing to work as a flight attendant.
Yes.
And according to...
Who are more than their looks. I'm sorry, I've said the thing about...
No, you were talking about in the contest. 60s. It was.
Yeah, the late 60s when it was kind of like, yeah.
It's a known thing in the 60s.
Good.
So, yeah.
All right.
You're good.
Thanks.
So I looked it up, of course, on our My Favorite Murder Gmail and found a murderino named Maggie B. Her mother, back then, babysat for the Crafts' children.
Wow.
And she said Richard was a... quote, bit of an oddball. Ugh. And that Hella was very sweet, very pretty, Swedish woman with a thick accent, and fuck him. I added that part. Okay. So the marriage is rocky, of course. Richard starts cheating on her even before they're married. When he's asked why they got married, he said, quote, Hella was pregnant at the time we were married. It was too far advanced for a doctor to perform an abortion, and we decided to get married. So the most romantic,
just
man.
Romance at the height of, it's called like a deep human soul connection.
Yes.
When you get married, because it's too late to get an abortion.
That's what Oprah calls it. Deep human.
Deep human soul connection.
Minus an abortion.
Yeah.
So during their marriage, Richard's just fucking cheating all the time. He has all these affairs. He would disappear for days at a time and never say where he was. And he also bought a shit ton of guns.
Oh.
For whatever reason.
Because that's sexy?
I guess.
For his dates?
Yeah.
Oh, and because he's an auxiliary policeman.
Yeah. So he was obsessed with guns. Yeah. They made a pretty good wage because of being in the airline industry is good. Mm-hmm. And so he spent it all. He didn't give her any money. He spent all the money on fucking guns and shit.
Wow.
And in the months leading up to her disappearance, Hella had discovered phone calls to an unknown number. And she's like, he's fucking doing it again. Like, she'd kind of ignored it because of the kids and stuff. And he probably promised he wasn't doing it anymore. So to confirm her suspicions, she hires a private detective. He's a former Connecticut cop. His name is Keith Mayo.
Okay.
Which I love. He'd be played Mayo. Like,
I've heard of his clinic.
That's
it's
right.
Amazing.
That's right.
It has all the best mayonnaise.
That's right. This guy's the best. He'd be played by a young mustachioed Paul Giamatti.
Hello.
Which I think any movie that My Favorite Murder makes is going to have Paul Giamatti in it.
We got to. And also, just in terms of being a utility character actor,
right.
You can slap a very slight toupee on him and he's a completely different person.
Yep.
You can paint him blue. You can do whatever it takes.
And the biopic of Blue Man Group. Paint him blue.
Blue Man Group, fucking Avatar.
That's right.
Or his great film, Big Fat Liar, which my entire family is obsessed with.
Or his cameo in the forthcoming book, Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered, the audiobook.
That's right.
Is that known yet? Did we talk about it?
I think we have talked about it, but we might as well brag on it a little bit more.
Paul Giamatti
is helping us read our audiobook.
Yeah.
Here and there.
He reached out to us and we were like, hi, will you do this? Is this really you?
Yep.
Are you making fun of us?
Yes.
And he was like, yes, no. I think.
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The end. Paul Giamatti.
You'll see. Oh, you'll see.
You'll see when you listen to the audiobook. And yes, we read it too. Okay. So Keith Mayo confirms that not only is Richard having another affair, he's had one girlfriend in particular in New Jersey who he had been seeing for years.
Oh, I hate that. Look, I hate that so much. It's so fucking mean to the other person.
Oh.
It's so mean to pretend that you're doing, to pretend that you are sharing a reality when you're not.
Yeah.
I think that's so fucking shitty.
Like, to trick the person into thinking that their life is what is one thing, and it turns out it's incomplete. Like, just tell them that their knife, like, you have to go crazy when you find that out, right?
Yes, because then suddenly it's just like, it's one thing to have an affair with people you don't care about, and yeah, it's like, oh, he can't stop fucking,
that
whatever.
Sucks. Yes.
But to be posted up with a totally other person and just have, like, a secret life.
And being like, I love you, and spending all your emotional fucking energy on them, and
it's nightmare. It's just everyone's worst nightmare. Yeah. Where it's like, you're keeping something from me, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, this guy was really doing it, and clearly didn't care about how it impacted.
And was fucking around too. So it's like,
he was even fucking the secret girl. I mean, fucking over the secret girlfriend.
Yeah,
it's like, no one's safe with Al Martino, whatever the hell his name is.
No, that's the father of the Instagram.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Shit, I'm so sorry.
No, wait.
What's his name? Sorry. What's the husband's name?
Richard Crafts.
Thank you.
Okay.
No one's safe with Richard Crafts. Steven, that's an easy pull.
No, it's
no
not.
No one's safe with
Leave it.
Okay.
Leave it. We're here. We're raw. This we're is, un...
We're flawed and raw, and we love chaos.
Yeah, chaos reigns. We accuse people of shit. Okay. Now that she has proof of his infidelity, she files for divorce, and she told her friends that she had feared for her life, and that and they kind of believed her because she told them, you know, she had confided in her friends about what a dick he was, and she had appeared in public multiple times with bruises on her face. So her divorce lawyer said that she told them that, quote, if anything happened to me, we should not believe that it was an accident.
Ugh.
Which is like,
how many
sucks.
Times have we said that, though, also
so
in
many
stories?
Every
it's
time.
Women who know what's coming.
That's
it's
right.
It's the worst.
It's so sad. And she also told her lawyer that Richard had a shit ton of guns and that he had physically abused her in the past. So, despite the fact that he was cheating on her, she decided to obtain a no-fault divorce as opposed to charge him with adultery. And I'm, you know, I can imagine it's just like, let's make this as, like, let's not fucking make him angry. Like,
yes.
let's make this as easy as possible. It's not like make him react in any way. It sucks so bad.
She's just trying to slide out the door.
That's
and
right.
Close it behind her so she can get out, like, free and clear.
That's right.
Yeah.
So she did that. And she was concerned about the children as well, how he would react. The divorce papers were written up, but they're never served, because on November 18th, 1986, 39-year-old Hella returns from working on a flight from Germany, and she's dropped off at her house by two other flight attendants. Mm-hmm. And they knew about the rocky relationship with Richard, so when they dropped her off and she was like, oh shit, he's home, because I think they still live together, they understood. So it was the last time anyone aside from her husband saw her alive.
Mm-hmm.
So her friends become concerned when they haven't heard from Hella, and Richard starts telling everyone a different fucking story, like she was on another flight, or she was at home in Denmark with her mom, and her mom's like, no dudes, she's not home with me, and probably like just like that. Mm-hmm. And he gave different stories to everyone. So one of Hella's coworkers named Rita didn't believe Richard's bullshit and was worried about her friend. So she reports Hella missing on the 1st of December, 2 weeks after she had gone missing.
Wow.
So when the police questioned Richard, who by now is an actual policeman with the neighboring county, he gives them a bunch of bullshit. He passes a lie detector test. And so they're like, great. And they didn't fucking worry about it. Mm-hmm. And so here comes fucking Mr. Mayo, Keith Mayo.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Who, like, got hired for this job of proving that he was cheating. And he was like, fuck this shit.
Yes.
He's like, I'm getting involved. This is bullshit.
Yay.
He was worried about his client. So he decided he needed to find evidence to convince the police to take Hella's disappearance seriously. He finds in the papers provided by Hella, he finds a receipt for a chainsaw. And then he learns that the au pair tells him that Richard had cut out pieces of his bedroom rug and discarded them at a local dump.
Thank you, au pair.
That's right.
Seriously, that was some key fucking evidence.
Yeah, she's definitely mandatory in this whole case.
Okay, nice.
So he's like, we're going to the dump. This guy, this fucking private investigator, he, with the help of a local trash trash pickup crew. They find out which dump the craft's trash would have been taken to, and they go. It's like 2 hours east of Newtown. He recruits a few helpers, and for the next several days, they search the mountain of trash at the dump.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, no.
But they do succeed in locating a portion of rug that's nearly identical to the rug at the craft's residence. And it's taken to the state police laboratory in Meriden, led by a young forensics investigator for the state police, none other than, and it's the first episode of Forensic Files, Dr. Henry Lee.
There he is.
There he is.
He should be on the first episode of Forensic Files.
This took place in, the Forensic Files was aired in 1996. So I was 16 when I'm sure I first fucking saw this.
I was flying on diet pills, age 26.
And Henry Lee was just a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed forensics dude.
That's amazing.
Yeah. He's one of the country's foremost forensic scientists already, though. So Hella's friends also kept up a nonstop campaign of calling the police for updates about the investigation, because they fucking knew that she wouldn't have just disappeared and left her children behind,
no.
Of course. And as a result, the state's attorney's office, so they fucking usurp the local cops, they decide that the investigation should be handled in total by the Connecticut State Police.
Good.
So they take the fucking case away.
That's what that's for.
That's right. So when they looked into his behavior, finally, without note, because they didn't know him and didn't give a shit, right?
Yep, they weren't buddies.
They look into his behavior right after she disappeared, and they find some strange shit. So aside from several pieces of the carpet in the bedroom that had been removed, he had completely remodeled their bedroom. Mm. And then Dr. Lee performed, of course, it's the first episode of Forensic Files, a luminol test.
Luminol test.
Yay. In various locations, they test positive for the presence of blood. And among Richard's credit card records, they find that he had purchased a new freezer, chainsaw he had bought also. They find that he had rented a 2,700-pound wood chipper and a U-Haul truck shortly before Hella disappeared.
Oh, God.
Also, his numerous affairs continued after Hella disappeared, and never once did he mention to any of these fucking women who knew he was married that his wife was missing. And then Hella's car is found in an employee airport parking lot. So when the story of Hella's disappearance finally starts making the news, because someone's fucking taking it seriously, the snowplow driver comes forward, and he's like, I know Richard. He knew him by sight. I saw Mr. Crafts using the wood chipper near the lake in the early morning hours right after she disappeared. There had been a severe winter storm that had hit Connecticut, and it was snow and sleet everywhere, gusty winds. And so they were emergency snow plowing the roads. Mm. And he drives past his U-Haul and he sees a fucking wood chipper attached to it. And then he sees this Richard Crafts, and he's like, that's fucking weird.
That's weird out in the middle of this post snowstorm
right.
day.
So when he finds out that his wife is missing, he comes forward.
Good. Good job, snowplow guy.
That's right.
I like to call you Mr. Plow.
Because his name again is?
Mr. Plow.
Thank you. Okay, police go to the scene of where the wood chipper was seen. And they find there's a scattering of wood chips under a layer of dead leaves. And among those wood chips, they also find a human thumb.
Ooh.
A fingertip with the nail attached, covered in pink nail polish. 2,660 strands of blonde hair, a big toe, 69 slivers of human bone, a truncated piece of human skull, 5 droplets of human blood, and a mailing label with Hella Craft's name on it and 2 teeth.
Ugh.
So awful. That's all that's fucking left.
Also, slight sidebar, but wood chippers themselves are frightening machines.
I've never.
So is those kinds of things were always around growing up because like my aunt and uncle had a farm.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were, and we lived on Eucalyptus Avenue.
Oh, shit.
And there was a eucalyptus grove between our house and my Aunt Jean's house. So they used to have to go into the creek every year and cut down trees and then put them in the wood chipper.
Okay.
And there's a famous family story of them doing it. My dad, my Uncle Steve, and my cousin Stevie. And I think Stevie was like a 17 or 18. And they were throwing stuff in the wood chipper, and Stevie threw a branch. It caught in his sleeve.
No.
His arm started going into the wood chipper connected to this branch that was basically gravity
yeah.
pulling him in. And my dad turned around and yanked him back out basically like saved his arm.
Holy shit.
In a thing that happened, when they came back and retold the story, they were all white, like completely pale gray, and were just like, and you're, my cousin Stevie, who was such an asshole growing up, and he like turned to me and my sister, he's like, your dad saved my arm. Like,
he didn't save his arm. He probably would have bled out.
Yeah.
Like, if your arm gets chewed off in there, it's just going to be massive amounts of blood loss. If you're out in the middle of the fucking farm and you have to, what is like a half an hour to town?
You're so right. Also, that's an I Survived, where the guy gets his arms cut off in the combine, and he lives. And they get reattached. But also, it's the thing of, in that moment, like, I think about this all the time. I freeze sometimes when things like that happen. Like, if somebody screams or there's a loud noise, oftentimes it'll be like, wait, what's going on? But I think because my dad was a fireman, he just had that thing of, you just act.
For
sure. Don't judge it.
And you don't panic either. He probably has had so much experience in not panicking, whereas, like, we don't see shit like that all the time. So right. We do panic.
Yeah. They're just...
Close calls.
And wood chippers are just... So scary.
Well, this motherfucker.
Yeah. Ugh.
So, okay. And in total, Dr. Henry Lee's team found just a total of 3 ounces of human remains.
Wow.
Total. So Dr. Henry Lee determined that the O-type blood positive was a match to Hella's and that the bone fragments belonged to a human. And a forensic odontologist was able to identify the tooth as belonging to Hella Crafts. So they confirmed that it was her body. In addition, they uncovered a submerged chainsaw in the Housatonic River. Or House Satanic River?
It's House Satanic.
Yes, that's it. That's the one. The chainsaw had blonde hairs intertwined in the chains, and inside the rented U-Haul van, they also found a clump of human tissue-like material that tested positive for human blood.
Fucking monster.
So this guy was like a monster and messy and like not good.
Disgusting.
Yeah, he was like a mile from his house. He was so cocky that he would never get caught that he just didn't even fucking care.
Psychopath.
Yeah. So based on this information, of course, Hella Crafts is pronounced dead, and 50-year-old Richard is arrested when he arrives home from a Christmas ski trip with his children.
Wow.
Right after their mother goes disappearing. That's what it is. Prosecutors, they face a double burden, because not only did they have to convince the jury that Hella was actually dead because they didn't have, quote unquote, a body,
right,
which had never happened. There's never been a trial in Connecticut up until this point where there wasn't a body, and a murder trial. And they also had to convince the jury that Richard was the one who killed her. So there was no physical body. And the motive, they argued, was that Richard didn't want to get a divorce, of course. Mm. They theorized that Richard first struck Hella unconscious with something blunt in their bedroom. And then he carried her body to the freezer, where he left her to freeze, assuming because it's easier and less messy to put through the wood chipper, which is so fucking awful.
Disgusting.
Like, to think that through in those details, and then it's also your wife and the mother of your children.
I mean... It is the thing of, this is the difference where you can, this is the difference of when you have a conscience and when you don't.
Right.
Because thinking about the scene from Fargo where of the wood chipper, I get sick and like, I don't want to think about it anymore.
And this person who's being wood chipped is a fucking, supposed to be a terrible character.
It's a terrible character, but also it's like, it's a prop leg sticking. You know what I mean? It's as fake as it can be. And I don't like thinking about it.
Yeah. And the person who puts him through is like a dead eyed monster.
Yes.
And this person did it to his fucking wife.
Yeah.
Which is sick. So he then took Hella's body to the river, where he was seen by the snowplower. Thank God.
Mr. Plow.
and chopped into several pieces with the chainsaw and then put through the wood chipper.
I mean, just
we're sickening. I mean, think about your children. They're going to have to fucking grow up knowing this.
He doesn't think about anybody.
Of course
though.
Not. The police believe that he then scattered the pieces in the river and around the surrounding area. So during his trial, the couple's housekeeper, Dawn Thomas, tells the courtroom that on the day of Hella's disappearance, Richard had allowed her to go home early, and she testified that Richard had removed a freezer and a carpet with a large black stain from their home just a couple days after Hella disappeared.
I fucking love these witnesses. I love them with my heart.
It's bananas. When Dawn is asked about the peculiar, when Dawn is like, Richard, what's that fucking stain? Mr. Crafts, whatever. He's like, I spilled kerosene and I don't want you to clean it. I'm just going to cut the fucking carpet out.
Yeah. You mean because you had your hurricane lamp up in the bedroom?
Right.
You fucking piece of shit.
Hella's friend Susan Lawson tells the court that Richard had physically abused Hella before and that he had lied. He had said his colon cancer had come back And when Hella called the doctor to confirm that, it turned out he was lying to get her to not go through with the divorce.
Oh, God.
That's right. Then Richard Kraft's own brother-in-law testified that when the state police divers started looking for his wife in the rivers, he said, quote, "Let them dive. There's no body. It's gone." His own brother-in-law did that. After 100 fucking witnesses and 650 exhibits are presented in a 53-day trial, which I guess is a very fucking long time, the jury deliberates for 17 days. And on July 15th, 1988, a mistrial is fucking declared.
No.
Yes.
What?
Because there was one motherfucking jury member who, it was 11 to 1 in favor of conviction. One jury member walks out because he refuses to vote to convict. So it was a mistrial. He was just somehow like, I don't think.
And that man was Mitch McConnell. Fucking piece of shit.
The prosecutors, bless their hearts, they're like, fuck you, we're doing this again. Like,
good.
They were.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God. They were like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. So the second trial scheduled for the following year. This time the prosecution's able to successfully argue that Hella had been murdered, and it took only 8 hours to reach a unanimous verdict. 3 years and 2 days since Hella was last seen alive, the jury found that Richard was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Phew. And at his sentencing, he says, quote, "A great deal has been said about my apparent lack of emotion. I have feelings like everyone else," which is like, how do you think you do? It's that weird psychopath thing where it's like, this is how everyone feels about things.
Right.
You don't know what other people's emotions are.
And the blindness
yeah.
to when you finally go to say something, it's all about, oh my God, this is so hard for me.
Right.
You're not even smart enough to not do the thing that psychopaths always do, which is, I've been through a lot in this trial, where it's like, you idiot.
Yeah.
You're pointing back at yourself again.
Totally. It's like these people are so manipulating and cunning and fucking like, what's like nefarious?
Mentally ill.
Yes. But then they're like, pretty stupid, because they don't think with empathy and with an open
hubris.
Mind.
Hubris.
Okay, that's the one.
It's hubris.
That guy.
They think, it's what you said, they think they're smarter than everybody.
Yeah.
So there's no, in their mind, there's no way they can mess up.
Right.
Because they have already thought it all through and they know everything.
Right.
Nightmare. Okay.
So he maintained his innocence and continued to say that Hella had just disappeared. At his sentencing, Richard's own fucking sister, who by then had custody of the couple's three children.
Oh.
I know. She urged the judge to impose the maximum sentence, his own sister.
Shit.
He's sentenced to 50 years in prison. Yay. Keith Mayo. Let's find out. I was like, what happened to Keith Mayo, though? And so I Googled him. He sent a registered letter to the police commission chairman asking for an independent investigation into why the Newtown police did not take Hella's missing persons report seriously. So he called for an investigation of the conduct of the police department's detective bureau, which is like, you fucking double down. Like, he didn't need to be involved in any of this, but he was like, I'm going to follow this through.
Yeah.
Which is so fucking.
He cared.
Amazing. Sadly, in 1999, at 46 years old, Keith Mayo died from injuries suffered in a car accident.
Oh, no.
I know, I was so bummed when I saw that.
That's so young.
I know. He was survived by his wife and three children. Hella Kraft's murder was a landmark case. It advanced forensic science greatly. It involved serology, radiology, ballistics, hair and fiber experts, and FBI experts. And it was the first case in which somebody was convicted of murder with no body in the state of Connecticut.
What's that called? Habeas? I've been trying to think of it.
Corpus delicti.
For real?
Yeah.
Here's how I was trying to think of it.
Delicti.
Yes, that's delicti.
Corpus delicti.
Because I just saw them talking about it on another Forensic Files when we were on tour.
Yeah, I think I watched that one too. No hotel.
We were watching it at the same time.
Yeah.
The one Skip Hollinsworth was on.
Oh, Skip.
I kept thinking how funny it is. Delecti may sound like delicious body.
Yeah, delectable.
Yeah. So as I was trying to think of it, like, I was going to sound so smart if I could come up with habeas corpus delecti. But I was like, habeas delicious. Like, I kept thinking of it. I'm like, just don't say
no,
anything.
No.
Just
I only know it because I listened to No Stone Unturned, the study of the... what are they called? No Stone Unturned, which is the story of necrosearch who find bodies that that have been hidden, and because of that, they can try the murderers because they have a body. Okay,
right.
A couple of years ago, Joel Cohen admitted in a Huffington Post article that the wood chipper scene in Fargo is directly inspired by the murder of Hella Kraft.
That makes perfect sense.
And the earliest Richard can be released is August 2021, when he'll be 84 years old. So let's fucking Keith Mayo that shit and keep him in prison.
They will. I know. Especially, I mean, like, it's infamous.
Yeah.
And he's 80. Where's he going to go now?
Totally. And that's the story of the murder of Hella Crafts.
Wow. God. Great idea.
Thanks. I'm just going to start doing that. Unsolved Mysteries. First episode. Cold Case Files. First episode.
I love that, though, because, you know, James Charles, the makeup guy that me and Nora, my niece Nora, love to watch together. He did that same thing where he went to the first YouTube makeup tutorial and did it along with the woman who did the first YouTube makeup tutorial.
Legend.
It's the funniest. It made us laugh so hard because it was like, clearly from like 1996 or whatever. And I think it was Bobby Brown. I think it was like, or Jane Iredell.
Someone was like, you know, it's a great idea. And everyone's like, why are you bothering with that?
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, no, come on, throw some bronzer on.
Yeah, no one's going to watch this.
And he did it along with, and he couldn't get over that she was applying foundation with her fingers. He was so grossed out. It was really funny.
Amazing.
If you find yourself falling into how it's made rabbit holes or staying up late researching every fact about a documentary you just watched, it's safe to say you're a curious person. The best way to indulge your curiosity is with Masterclass. Masterclass is the only streaming platform where you can learn directly from the world's biggest and brightest talents. For just $10 a month, you have unlimited access to over 200 classes on topics like songwriting, entrepreneurship, and gardening. Learn how to effectively compromise in the workplace from FBI hostage negotiator Chris Voss, or how to tell a great story with humor and emotion from New York Times bestselling author David Sedaris. Masterclass has short 10 to 15 minute lessons that you can access from any device, and 88% of members say the classes have made a positive impact on their lives. I am obsessed with Masterclass, and I love that I can use my phone to watch classes instead of just mindlessly scrolling. I can put on a creative writing class by Margaret Atwood. It's called How to Hook Readers and Create a World. Or, hey, are you a comedian? There's Steve Martin, whose class is What Your Flavor of Comedy Is and How to Nail Your Act. I mean, come on, you guys. Right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/MFM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/MFM. Masterclass.com/MFM. Goodbye.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant, like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Kraft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all made in, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. Goodbye.
Okay. Is it my turn?
It's your turn.
Okay. This was one I was thinking of doing for St. Louis for the live show.
Mm-hmm.
Too dark or big or heavy or whatever. So I didn't do it.
So it's so funny that, like, it's still dark and big and heavy. We just don't have to hear the audience silence when you say something terrible. That's the only difference.
Right. Yeah, our live show is more comedic. I would say it's like on the scale tips toward comedic as opposed to true crime.
Because
it's a fucking live show.
Yeah.
And that's the fun part. We definitely do the dark part, but
it's fun, but it's also hard to say all these horrible things and then have no reaction from the audience or.
Well, yeah. It's once you're in a live show setting and vibe, you just want those fucking laughs. And that's, I mean, I don't know what you want. That's what I want.
I want that.
That's all I want.
I don't want to talk about the horrible things. So tell me right now.
Okay. So in privacy with just Stephen watching,
yeah,
it's so much easier to tell you about the Kansas City Hyatt walkway collapse of 1981. Do you know about this?
Dude.
I'd never heard of it. And because sometimes I go like, oh, maybe there's a disaster that's like, you know, something to talk about. And these ones are awful, and it's human error, and it's innocent lives. So like, you know,
yeah,
it's very difficult to talk
about.
Can
I tell you though, what's so weird? The one I ended up, I had a murder, I said, and I changed my mind last minute because it was too gruesome. Mine was one I was going to do in Nashville, but was too gruesome for that. It was the Interstate 75 largest car crash in American history.
Why wouldn't
you? Do you remember that one?
Yes. Is it because of the fog?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's because of the fog from the paper mill. So it's not murder, but it's what's it called when you don't pay attention enough? When you're like,
you mean like human error? Or like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. So there's not. It's not like there's a villain or a bad guy.
Right.
It's like this could have happened. It could have been you.
No. Yes. And it's passive murder because the paper plants didn't give a shit and just like let this stuff happen for years and years.
Yes. Manslaughter, I think they call it.
Okay.
I mean,
I'll do it sometime in the future.
That's what you mean. Are you sure you haven't done that? Because that sounds super familiar.
Probably have. Let's be honest. I had to make Steven look up the one I just did right before we recorded because I was like, I bet I've done this before.
You just said that. Look, I probably have. Hey, look.
Don't judge me.
Listen. Okay.
Okay.
So we're in this fucked up story, but it's 1981, so let me set a little picture for you.
I'm so into this. I'm so here for this.
Okay, thank you. It's 81. It's not just before, which everything when we're talking about things like this, we're always like, it's before the internet or whatever. But this is so far back. 81 is like when everything was brown, tan, or moss green. The world was
muted.
Muted, dimmer, boring, flat, pre-video games. This was like, go outside and ride your bike or you're fucked. Or watch Bugs Bunny cartoons from 1944.
Right. And I Love Lucy.
Yes.
Go try to play Pong. And that was an exciting video game.
That's right. We begged my dad for fucking Pong.
Yeah.
And then Atari came out. We're like, no, we want Atari. And then he waited 3 years and got us Pong. Because Jim fought it. And he would always go like, we'd be like, Dad, please, can we get cable? Can we please have HBO? And he'd be like, we have it at the firehouse. You don't need it.
You're not missing out.
Like, I'll kill you. You're living the greatest life at the firehouse and coming home. And anyway, that's not what this is about.
Great.
1981.
Okay.
The Iran hostage crisis finally comes to a close. The Yorkshire Ripper is caught. Post-it notes are invented.
Oh.
So this is a time where it's like, we're not even talking about like digital this or digital that. We're talking about post-it notes hadn't even been around. Like, that was nuts.
Life starting.
Yes.
Like, you know, like pre-post-it notes. Like,
pre-post-it notes.
It's fucking piece of paper with like light glue on the back and you can't even figure that out.
Revolutionary.
Pre-80s.
If people were like, look, it's just a little square. I can do anything I want with it. Meanwhile, we had just gotten over the invention of whiteout where we're like, I can change pen mistakes.
Incredible.
Yeah. And every paper that you wrote, that I wrote in sixth grade weighed 6 pounds because you had so much whiteout on it.
Jesus.
And also Jay and I were just talking this morning about how calculators and how I was like, remember how hilarious it was when you would write boobs by writing 80085 on a calculator?
Or boobless.
There's a couple things you could do. And that to us was like, that was Twitter.
That was the height.
Holding up a calculator that said boobs was like fucking a tweet storm.
That's right.
This was full on Cro-Magnon era life. The first flight of the space shuttle Columbia happened. This was when the AIDS virus was identified.
Wow.
First identified, which I remember seeing on the news.
Which was already killing people, but they finally identified it.
They finally fucking said it was happening.
And then Reagan just made sure that everyone was okay afterwards, right?
No.
Oh, he fucking ignored it for years and years and decades.
Please.
Goodbye.
Lady Diana Spencer married Charles the
Prince
of Wales.
Oh, you can edit that out.
No. Okay. I mean, you're exactly right. And that is the world we lived in.
Yeah.
Also, and I'll just, as a side note to Lady Diana Spencer marrying Charles the Prince of Wales, there was such a Lady Di and Prince Charles fever that took over America in 1981, except in my grandma's house. And literally, if you talked about it, if you brought it up, if it came on the news, she would get so fucking pissed.
Why?
Because the Irish were oppressed by the British. There is no such thing as the Anglophilia that I fucking in betrayal of my grandma Anne, you know, loving all things British is so offensive to the Irish side of the family, because the reason our Irish family emigrated out of Longford and Galway was because the Browncoats were the British soldiers were in Ireland beating the shit out of children. My grandfather, as a child, was made to dig ditches for British soldiers instead of going to school.
Jesus.
It was crazy and they were awful.
Okay,
and so the charm did not come through. So I had the weirdest perspective as an 11-year-old because everyone's like, I want to get my hair cut like Lady Di or whatever. And I was like, this is all wrong. You should be doing these. She's aren't like good people.
She's breaking commemorative plates on her kitchen floor.
For real. She's like literally like spit on the ground type of like,
oh my god,
switching off TV. It was amazing. I love my grandma Anne. Okay. Anyway, so in May of 19, so we're gonna go back a little bit for the plans of this Hyatt Regency Kansas City. In May of 1978, construction begins. It is in the Crown Center District by Union Station. It's going to be 40 stories tall. Whoa. And it's going to feature a multi-story lobby atrium.
Okay.
So
like open air.
Yes. And the glass. All that. And again, this was before this, in the late 70s, early 80s, all ceilings were much lower than they should have been. And everything was brown carpet.
Right. It was like the inside of a depressing mall everywhere.
Yes. And it was all like the world was closing in on you in fucking earth tones.
In shades of earth tones.
It was a bummer.
And here comes Hyatt with a sweeping grand ceiling.
Look at the sky. Oh my God, the plants are growing so tall. Sweeping. So yeah, they're trying to be modern and, you know, atrium it up.
Got it.
So the engineers design floating walkways that are going to hang from the ceiling within the atrium at the second, third, and fourth floors, connecting the north and south wings of the hotel. So obviously this thing is massive, and it's basically like, it's going to be this futuristic internal.
And so they had these little bridges running across the open air to like get from this side of the thing to this side. You can look down. It's beautiful. You can look up. It's still beautiful. You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
This is your atrium, like, you know, fancy big hotel experience.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. So 4-story walkway sits directly above the 2-story walkway, while the 3-story walkway is offset from that.
Okay.
So they basically, you know, are doing that. That kind of thing.
Got it.
They were playing with levels. I'll talk about architecture later.
I wish you would.
In 2025. So as the building starts, there's delays and setbacks, which happens during all construction. But for this one, it was pretty bad. Most notably, at one point, a 2,700 square foot portion of the roof collapses while they're building it. So miraculously, no one was hurt in that accident, but it causes a significant delay in construction. So finally, on July 1st, 1980, the hotel officially opens. So for the next year, everything's regular, business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Normal hotel atrium floating walkway shit.
Got it.
Then on the evening of Friday, July 17th, 1981, there's a crowd of roughly 1,600 people who have gathered in the lobby atrium area for the tea dance that the hotel put on for guests and whoever wanted to come.
Like regularly?
Yes.
There's dance?
A tea dance. So it was basically an evening, early evening. Like it was apparently, we looked it up. I, of course, clicked that link on Wikipedia where it's like, what the fuck is a tea dance?
Yeah.
And basically like after, you know, sorry to go back, Grandma Anne, to British culture, but after tea, there was a common thing like in tea rooms, they would have dances.
Okay.
So it'd be like early evening, fancy dress, fancy people.
Right.
Socializing.
Right.
Post-tea socializing.
Got it.
And that's kind of what this was.
Which is so, like, why would you want to speak to anyone else in the hotel room if you're one of those people?
Right.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So there's us upstairs in their room safely watching Forensic Files, loving life. But then there's a bunch of people, a ton of fucking people, 1,600 people downstairs having a tea dance, basically pretending to be fancy.
Being social.
Yeah.
And
being in the newly built 40-story hotel that's like
for them.
Elegance.
Got it.
So And then, of course, the rest of the hotel is business as usual. So there's foot traffic and there's people everywhere. There's about 40 people standing on or walking across the second story walkway and about 16 to 20 people on the fourth story walkway. So you have to also imagine that you've gone up and say your rooms are there, whatever. But you can look out over these walkways and see the lobby and see what everyone's doing down there.
I don't want to.
You have to.
Picture it now.
Look at it.
Bring yourself
in your mind's eye.
I don't want to
hear the music. It's the last place you'd ever think anything bad would happen.
Yeah.
A tea dance.
Yeah.
Suddenly it's 7:05 p.m. Patrons of the hotel, and this is so sickening.
I hate it.
Hear a popping noises ring out from the fourth story walkway. The walkway itself drops several inches, pauses for a moment, and then collapses completely onto the second story walkway that sits below it. And upon impact, the four story takes the second story walkway out with it, and both of them come crashing down onto the tea dance and the lobby below.
How long of a period was it? The seconds that that whole thing happened.
Right. It was basically like this had Boom. Been, well, I'll tell you a little bit about it, but it was like, and then crash.
This is why I don't ever want to leave the house.
I know. And these stories don't help.
So keep going.
So here we go. So lock in and feel this fear and then let it go later. Okay. So of course, the people in the lobby, the people at this fucking tea dance are immediately buried in a massive pile of steel, concrete, and glass. So it's bad news, obviously. Emergency vehicles arrive on the scene, firefighters, and this is bad too. The firefighters use their jacks to lift and remove the rubble and to rescue people. But of course, there's so much rubble and it's so heavy because there's so much steel.
Yeah.
They have to get local construction companies to come and bring their own jacks, concrete saws, jackhammers, torches, generators, even cranes to get in and start lifting this rubble off of survivors. Any type of machinery that would help that rescue mission got brought in. So everybody just like, it was like the call went out.
Yeah. I'm picturing remember the, was it 94 earthquake when the twin bridges?
In the Bay Area?
Yeah, the Bay Area double story bridges.
Yeah.
What was that called?
That was the 89 earthquake.
Okay, thank you.
And the Bay Bridge collapsed, the top layer collapsed onto the bottom layer.
Right. And I just remember watching the news and,
horrifying.
Horrifying.
Yes.
I was nine and I watched the news for the rest of the
Of course you did. Why wouldn't a 9-year old be watching the nightly news?
Right.
Of course you were. Also, if you haven't, just to slightly silver line that one, having nothing to do with the tragedy of that, but the new Bay Bridge is so beautiful and amazing to drive over. If you hadn't had the chance, the top level as you're going from the Berkeley side into San Francisco has these spanners. Like, it is so beautiful and amazing to drive over now. Every time I do it, I love it.
Who knew Karen was a bridgehead?
I'm kind of into bridges and connecting with people. What? Who what? Who is that girl?
Oh, no.
Okay. Sorry. So the chief of Kansas City's emergency medical system was named Dr. Joseph, I'm going to say Wackerly.
Great.
Or Wakerly.
Okay.
Thank you for my permission. He leads the search and rescue mission. So at his direction, first responders, they set up a morgue in the exhibition area of the hotel on the ground floor, basically, that's right by there. They have to use the hotel's driveway and front lawn as the triage centers. That's how many people have been injured or killed. So the victims with the most severe injuries obviously are treated first. Anyone who can still walk is told to just get off the site immediately, like just taken away.
Wow.
So the triage was basically dedicated to the very, very wounded or mortally wounded. And that was basically just they needed people out to minimize the chaos.
Chaos.
Okay, so there are living people buried in the rubble, obviously.
Uh-huh.
And the first responders have to dig down to them. And in doing so, they come upon dead bodies that are blocking the way. So these first responders, at certain points, some of them were forced to dismember dead bodies to get to trapped survivors underneath.
That's not something you get past in the weeks and months after this. If you're the first responders, I mean.
No.
You know?
Absolutely not. No, and that's part of the risk and that's part of the sacrifice that first responders make.
Yeah.
It's like what we're talking about before where you see you're the person that gets called when the worst thing happens.
Yeah.
That takes a toll on anybody.
Totally.
And that's why, like, I think I hear often ambulance drivers do it for like a certain amount of time and then they have to get out.
Yeah.
Because you can't just keep taking that on.
No.
That's, you know, that's really hard. So, yes. And this is just like, It's the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Also inside the hotel, the visibility is terrible.
Right.
Because there's debris and dust in the air. And then also, the power got shut off so that there wouldn't be electrical fires.
Ay, vey.
So, then also the emergency sprinkler system is on.
Shit.
Because the, it's been triggered and they can't turn it off. So the lobby starts to flood.
No.
During this fucking rescue.
No.
So it's fucking like the fucking Poseidon Adventure.
Dude.
I don't need to say fucking that much, but it's so upsetting.
I
do. So you do. Okay. So now the people who are alive under the rubble are at risk of drowning on top of fucking everything else.
Mm-mm.
There is a survivor named Mark Williams who tells a story about being trapped under a beam. Both his legs have been dislocated and the water came up to the point where he almost drowned. They saved him right in time.
Oh.
He was like on the verge of drowning and then they finally got to him and got him out.
Oh my God.
How horrible is that?
Yeah.
The entire rescue operation lasts 14 hours.
Jesus.
29 people are rescued from the debris, but by the end of it all, 114 people are pronounced dead. With an additional 219 people injured.
Oh my God, that's so many people.
It's so many people. But then if you think about the fact that there were almost 2,000 people in that lobby.
Yeah.
Because 1,600 were at the tea dance. But like, you know, then there's a bunch of other people. So obviously, it's so many people and it's horrifying, but it could have been worse.
Right.
I guess you could always say that. Okay. Yeah. So in the wake of the collapse, the local newspaper, the Kansas City Star, hires an architectural engineer named Wayne G. Lischka.
Wayne.
To investigate what went wrong.
Yes.
So 3 days later, on July 20th, 1981, Wayne finds the original design of the walkways, and he sees that they were changed during construction. The architectural firm was called Jack D. Gillum and Associates. I almost didn't name them because it's such a terrible thing, but this is essentially what happened because it's human error, but also nothing isn't, it's not because people were,
purposely.
Right. It wasn't.
Hurt, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, that architectural firm drew up the original designs for the walkways. They planned for there to be three pairs of steel tie rods running straight down from the ceiling through both the fourth and second floor walkways. So these six rods in total would secure both of the walkways to the ceilings.
Mm-hmm.
The rods would then be secured by nuts. And then I wrote, and perhaps bolts, because there's nothing funny about this story. So the steel company who manufactured those rods was called Haven Steel Company. They argued this design wouldn't work. They said that in order to fasten nuts onto the rods to hold the fourth floor walkway in place, the entire length of the rod from the fourth floor down would have to be threaded. So you know how, like, when you put a bolt on a screw?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
the whole thing would have to be that way, okay. They were saying. Because any slight chink in the threading would make it impossible to screw the nut all the way up from the bottom of the rod to the fourth floor walkway. It would be too delicate to execute.
Okay,
so Haven Steel Company's solution was instead to have two sets of six rods. The first set would run from the ceiling to the fourth floor walkway and then would be fastened to the walkway with nuts. And then the second set of rods would run from the fourth floor walkway down to the second floor walkway fastened by nuts. The problem with this alternate plan is instead of having the ceiling supporting both sets of walkways, you now have the ceiling supporting the fourth floor walkway and the fourth floor walkway supporting the second floor walkway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, not that you need this explained, but it helped me. It's like having two mountain climbers who are rappelling down the mountain face.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of having both of them have their things planted on top of the cliff going down, it's one guy has it coming down and then the second climber is attached to the first climber.
Right. So if one thing goes wrong, they're both fucked.
Right. And you can't, with that kind of like gravity pull,
right.
It's a single attachment. You know what I mean? They're too dependent, interdependent on each other.
Got it.
I am both an architect and a steel expert. So to make matters worse, the original design that the architecture firm drew up was already bad because it would have only held 60% of the minimum load required by Kansas City building code.
Okay.
So there was a code issue in the design. But under the new design plan offered by the Haven Steel Company, the weight-bearing capacity dropped to 30% of the required minimum. So that change of going, right. Oh, we'll just hang the one from the other, made it even worse.
Because it didn't have its own support.
So right, exactly.
Like even less
secure.
Got it.
Right.
Thank you.
So also on top of that, all the bolts were placed directly through the welded joints in the box beams. This is detail, but the joints are the weakest part of the beam. So that's basically where the beams bend or like come together.
Got it.
So they put all those, that's where they attached everything, which is the weakest part of the beam, not the middle, the strongest part of the
beam. Right.
Right.
It's like they so like if that had been in the middle, if those joints had failed, it wouldn't have been as disastrous if they were in the correct place to hold everything up.
Right, because it's like the strength of the beam is in the middle of the beam, not in the ends.
Right. I see. Yeah, so the middle has no support.
Right.
Got it.
So
I'm now an architect too.
I mean, this is so much bullshitting from me, but I think I get it.
I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah. I think I get it, and there's good pictures. Obviously, Wikipedia is the main main research, we can say it at the end.
Okay.
But they have pictures on there showing it, so it's much easier to visualize, obviously, looking at a picture.
Yeah. Visualizing a picture.
When did I become like a weird liar? That's what this feels like. Like I'm lying my way through this. Okay, so the issue ultimately becomes because of a lack of communication between those two companies, the steel company and the architect.
Right.
So the initial plans laid out by the architects were only meant to be preliminary sketches, but they were taken by the Haven Steel Corporation to be the final design.
Okay.
And when Havens proposed the new bolt fix to put it out on the joints,
yeah,
no one looked into whether or not that would work. The architects didn't. Nobody did.
They just went by what they already had, which wasn't the final design.
They were like, we think it would work better out here. The end.
Oh, my God.
The head engineer at the architecture firm was extremely busy and so assigned supervision of this build to an associate engineer. And the execs at the steel company pitched their design revision over the phone and the associate engineer approved it verbally.
Yay.
And now I go on to my rant about how much I hate conference calls and how it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Have the meeting, have every meeting face to face that you can.
Yeah.
Because nobody pays attention on the phone. You don't want to be on that call anyway.
No.
Of course you're playing solitaire while everyone's having this conversation.
I'm looking at Instagram cats.
Or it's like reading other emails.
Yeah.
It's we need to call an end to conference calls, Joe Schwartz, right now. Okay. When investigators later ask the associate engineer why he approved the revised plan, he says he believed a written request would then be filed after the phone call. Basically, everyone thought there was checks and balances systems in place
right.
that were not there.
Like a verbal okay does not mean start construction.
Exactly.
It's kind of like me where you get upset with me when I do this. Like, yep, sure, that sounds good. And I'm like, I'm going to fucking say no to this later. And then you're like, people think you mean yes. I'm like, no, I can say no to this later. I'm being nice on the conference call because I want to get off.
Right, exactly. It's conference call politics.
That's right.
We all get sucked into.
Sure, sounds great. Send it over.
And I'm like, no, don't push that rock down the hill. Now it's going to be a boulder. Okay. A lot of PTSD from producing television. Okay, so essentially with the cause of the collapse determined, the engineers at Gillum & Associates who approved the project were all found responsible of gross negligence, misconduct, unprofessional conduct in the practice of engineering by the Missouri Board of Architects, Professional Engineers, and Land Surveyors.
So everyone was mad at them.
All the fucking guys that wear khakis and put their hands on their hips and look into the distance with a flat hand above their eyes were pissed.
Hard hats everywhere.
Everywhere. Smashed to the ground. Stomped with large, wonderful Timberland boots. So they're charged with... they're initially charged with criminal charges, but they're eventually dropped. Instead, they just all lost their engineering licenses. So, of course, obviously, people had to pay. And yeah. I mean, like, the things needed to happen and change. The architecture company is also cleared of criminal negligence, but they lose their engineering license, can no longer operate as an engineering company in Missouri or Kansas. Mm. The victims and their families are awarded a total of about $140 million in judgments and settlements, which is almost $400 million today.
Good. Sometimes you hear these settlements and you're like, it's not even $1 million for all the victims' families. And it's fucking ridiculous.
No, I think especially because this was just, it was truly gross negligence where it's just like, there's no arguing. I bet you both of those companies didn't even argue. It's just like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
The problem is several rescuers suffered considerable PTSD because of what they had to experience in those rescues. And they actually formed, which I loved this so much, they had to later rely upon each other to form an informal support group to get through it, which is so beautiful. Because, of course, that's such a specific thing to need support for. You're not going to get that from just a normal, oh, I've been through something hard or whatever. It's like, that is a very specific thing, that kind of rescue, you know, first responder PTSD.
And I bet, you know, those, they're probably taught to like man up or whatever and like fucking deal with it and don't reach out. And the fact that not just one person, but multiple people reached out to be like, I'm not okay and I need help from this.
Yes.
Is just, it's a lesson to all of us.
It is. And the fact that it happened in 1981.
Yeah.
Back when, if you had were in therapy, you were out of your fucking mind. Like, my mom started going to therapy when I was in junior high and I was like, like, oh, are we gonna like, is it all falling apart now? Of course, I wanted it to, but
chaos.
Meanwhile, she was just in like Al-Anon, essentially.
Right.
She started going to Al-Anon to be like, it is bad when both your parents are alcoholics, right? Oh, that affected me.
That makes sense. I'm a psychiatric nurse, and this sucks.
Yes, and it's why I'm a psychiatric nurse.
Right.
The beautiful part is that the first responders who went through it came together. The terrible part is there is a jackhammer operator named Bill Allman who died by suicide because of the experiences that he had in this. So it is a true and total tragedy all the way around. Since then, this hotel has been renovated, rebranded several times.
Okay.
The latest was a $13 million renovation. It's now a Sheraton.
We didn't stay there when we were in St. Louis, did we?
We could have. it was completed in 2012. I mean, but here's the weirdest part. And Stephen, correct my math if I'm wrong. But it's been almost 40 years since this happened. 40 years.
See.
45, probably.
Yeah. How is it? Wait. Well,
maybe
I was born in
50.
80. No, I was born in 80 and I'm 38.
Do the math.
So minus one. So it's been 37 years.
It's been 37 years.
How is
since
that
this happened?
Real.
God, that's crazy. So, I just read the last line. And so that is the horrifying and terrifying story of the Kansas City Hyatt walkway collapse of 1981.
Amazing.
Nutso, right?
Good job.
Thank you.
No, that was, I have an anxiety disorder and I don't like leaving the house because so many bad things can happen when you do that.
It's true.
And that's one of them.
That's one of them. But also, and I know we talk about stuff like this a lot, but also lots of great things can happen.
Yeah.
So I think when we dedicate, because we often talk about like, why does this relieve our anxiety?
Yeah.
Why does this make us feel better? And it's because we can all sit here and go, this happened. It doesn't happen every day. It doesn't happen every year. It fucking almost never happens, but it did. So like, you can get that feeling of like, but now I'm aware.
Yeah.
So I'm not walking out into this mystery world.
Yeah.
Like ignorant. I know a little something.
Being aware that there's chaos in the world doesn't necessarily need to be a bad thing. It can just be that you walk around.
You walk around.
It could just be that you walk around with an awareness and maybe a little anxiety, but also, you know.
But then there's also the thing of then you can free up your mind to then focus on the good things that happen when you walk out your door.
Okay.
Because I have to remind myself of this a lot where it's like, if you stay in this house, the same thing's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know what's going to happen in this house. You have to get out and be around people and allow good things to happen so that is the thing that comes to mind when you look at the Hyatt Hotel and you're like, great things happen in there. It's not just the disasters and the horror things.
There's room service too.
Oh my God. Forensic Files is never not on. That's a miracle.
Yeah, that's a good point to remember is that good things happen to when you leave the house.
Just as often, if not more.
That's true.
You just have to focus. You have to teach yourself to notice it and pay it and give it as much credence as you do your fears.
Okay. Hey, speaking of.
I'm pointing at you, but I mean me.
Okay.
Three
I'm pointing
back.
At me, and I mean me too. Hey, let's.
Is anyone going to point at me?
Let's name one of those good things, shall
Great.
We?
Let's do
it's
it.
It's fucking hooray time.
Mm.
Do you want to go first or me to go first?
You do it.
Okay. So there's this thing called PRP. It's platelet-rich plasma, where they take your blood and put it in a centrifuge and separate the good stuff. And then
Platelets.
And then it inject it into a painful spot in your body, say my lower back that is very fucked up with degenerative disc bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And that platelet-rich plasma is supposed to heal that area. They use it for like a lot of that, like tennis elbow and bullshit, like wristy stuff.
Yeah.
So I got that this week.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And it's going to take a couple weeks to know if it works, but I'm really fucking hopeful. There was a murderino who worked in the office, so that was nice. And she
nice.
Was very sweet. She was at our Halloween show. Melissa, what's up? yeah. So I'm putting it out there because I really want it to work, and I'm hopeful that it will.
It'd That's be great.
Nice not to have back pain all the time anymore.
That's right. Great.
What's yours? Are you going to cry?
No. But if I were to, I would be fine with it. Well, I guess I will say this. This is like from today. And I know I talk about my therapist like she's my fucking hooray a lot.
It's a very important relationship in our lives.
It is. And it also is just this. I feel like there's this pipeline of information that I get from her. Like all the things I was just saying to you is fucking straight out of her mouth.
Yeah.
That I've just gone, oh, yeah. Like this idea that you're this way. You're just a way. And that's your fucking fault.
Right.
And like too bad for you or whatever is like you. One of the things I love about therapy is there's a person there going, excuse me, I just have a quick argument for that. And so whatever thing I put on the table, you know, it's just a person going, and she, you know, we've talked about like, it's that thing of when you're in a trauma response and you can't tell because you just think you're trying to deal with the shit that's going on.
You just think you're responding.
Right. And we were talking about the voice that comes up when you're experiencing like, say, rejection or, you know, whatever, some negative thing. And mm-hmm. I have this voice because I've talked about this, but it's the rule of six where you're the thing that you fear you think is happening.
Right.
And that's your forearm.
Right.
But then your open hand is the five other possibilities that could be happening.
Right.
And the practice is to go through and just be like, what else could it be besides this thing I've decided?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, that's all well and good. You've been telling me to do this for about 15 years.
Yeah.
But there is a voice in my head that I like to, like, I believe is like the realist, who's always like, well, that's fine, but the truth is,
yeah,
you're just gross.
You know the truth,
Stop
Karen.
Being sad. Right. Stop being pathetic. You're gross. It seems to be what that voice always says.
Yeah.
And the voice says it nicely, like warmly.
It's okay. You're just a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Like, and you know it too, and it's fine.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can be like, you're mean.
No, no, no. It's like, it's almost like, oh, this close friend that's just letting me know the reality of
it.
And so then to me, and she and I have talked about this too, is like you running through the other scenarios seems pathetic and immature to me. It mm-hmm. seems like what a sad person would do.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm just like, look, I'm a realist. I get it. I'm just gross, whatever. And so she said this thing, she goes, no, 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 I have that voice too. And then she threw her head back and smiled and goes, but I'm on to her.
Aww.
I'm on to her. And I was just like, you are the best, like, because she's not saying from up here, here's your diagnosis and here's what you need to do. She's going, this is the human fucking condition.
Yeah.
This is what we do to ourselves. And we're doing it because we think it's going to keep us safe and secure.
And also because it's worked at some point in your life.
Right.
And it's done what you needed it to do at some point in your life.
Yes.
And now you're an adult and you're in different circumstances and it's the thing you know how to do. So you continue to do it. I do it too.
Yeah.
You continue to do it because it's always worked and maybe there's a different way. And I love that she was like, let me show you an example. It's not that you stop doing that, period. Karen, won't you learn how to fucking do this?
Right.
It's, no, I'm paying attention and I can tell that that's not the right response. Like, that's not the response that feels good to me.
Right.
That's a different fucking response.
It's like the metaphor she used is like, you know, in a brilliant mind, when he finally caught on that have we talked about this?
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's really good, but he has schizophrenia, but he's also this brilliant mathematician.
Yeah.
And when he finally catches on that he's having these not hallucinations, but he's in basically having his like psychotic episode, mm-hmm. is all the people that aren't really there that he thinks are there, they never age and he ages. And he finally at the end of the movie is like, how come you're not as old as I am? And then the person disappears.
Oh, you just spoiled it.
Guess what? You had fucking 10 years to watch that movie.
It's fair. I did.
I spoiled it for you. I'm sorry.
No, is that a surprise?
Well, you see it happening where you know that he's in that
movie. Okay. Bruce Willis is dead.
He's dead the whole time.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's that thing where like when things feel dire, all of this is to say, when things feel dire and black and white and my life is on the line, everything's on the line. If one move happens, this is going to be, if Georgia says yes on the phone, that's what we're going to have to do. The end. I can't take it back. There's nothing. And I panic. Mm-hmm. And it's that thing of like, you have to go, or nothing happens. And everyone knows that this is all conversation and it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. And you can like walk it backwards.
Or if I do fuck something up, maybe it can be corrected at some point. It's not like I didn't sign anything, Your Honor. Show me my signature.
Prove it. Prove I fucking said it. And then they're playing tapes back from conference calls. Here's you. Sorry, we already had it. So, I mean, whatever. It's like perspective, but it's like the idea that we can even be having that conversation at this point when I've lived in basically trauma pocket panic mode for like so long.
Yeah.
That fucking hooray for perspective, I guess.
I love that.
Is what I'm trying to say.
I'm gonna use it too. I'm gonna steal your fucking hooray and I'm gonna try to do it.
I mean, that's the name.
I wish you could see Karen. She's grabbing her wrist, her like forearm.
That's what she does every time.
Puts her five hands up. That's the new Murderino salute.
Yeah. It's five fingers. It's the rule of six.
Yeah.
Grab your forearm and then spread your hand like it's a high five.
Yeah.
That you're keeping yourself from giving another person.
But grip really hard, because this is difficult. Just really,
really hard.
I'm trying really hard.
Strangle that first thing that you assume. Right. And really try to get those five other fingers
and then
going.
Count five other options. I love it.
It's really hard. All right.
Thanks for listening, you guys.
Thanks for being here with us.
Yeah. We hope you can use some of our bullshit to help your bullshit.
And don't be afraid to send your bullshit into us and let us have yours at myfavoritemurder.blogspot.org. Right?
No.
Please go look at our new website at myfavoritemurder.com.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Thanks for sticking with us.
Stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Goodbye.
Elvis, you want a cookie?